Hello and welcome to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus and Community Radio. I'm your host, Adam A. Donaldson, and joining me in a bit will be Peter Salmon. And this is our last sort of regular show, if there is such a thing anymore. Our last regular show of 2020. In the next couple of weeks, we'll be airing a couple of holiday specials and then get back into it in 2021. Can hardly believe it's actually almost 2021, but there we are. Seems like it really sneaked up on us. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when 2021 sounded like the far future, and here we are now, in a few weeks away from 2021. So I have nothing left to add on that part. End Credits is a local movie show for local movie fans. We are here every Wednesday at 3 p.m. to talk the latest in pop culture and review the newest movies, which this week will be the new Hollywood biopic Mank, which you can now stream on the Netflix. So before taking our holiday break, I thought we might, one last shot at the news, as it were. It seems to be a thing. I mean, now that we kind of have production in full swing again, and we have Hollywood studios taking specific direction to deal with release dates and other things, it seems like the news is coming with a bit more of a quicker clip lately. And there was a lot of news this week from one studio in particular, and I will run that down in a second. I do want to catch up on a couple of things. Number one is, you may remember a few weeks ago I talked about Wonder Woman 1984, how it was being released on HBO Max on the same day it was being released in theaters in the United States. We do not, however, have HBO Max in Canada, even though Crave does air a great deal of the HBO Max content. But movies, it seems, like with The Witches, which came out back in October on HBO Max in the States, but not in Canada. There seems to be some sort of, logistical backflips that have to be done. But, I mean, in the case of Wonder Woman 84, there is good news. We have learned that it will be released on premium VOD platforms in Canada on Christmas Day. So if you are living in an area where there is no movie screenings, and we're kind of back in that area because we Guelph went into the level red on Monday, so that means no movies anymore until we are back in orange level. So that is especially good news. Now you can watch Wonder Woman 1984 on Christmas Day probably on the usual suspects like the Cineplex site or Google Play or Apple TV. It is going to cost you. If you are living on your own, it's $29.99. I mean, no matter how many people live in your house, it's $29.99. But if you were planning on going as a family, with the members of your household, of course, if you're a family of four, being able to sit around the TV and watch Wonder Woman 1984 for $29.99, that's about $8 per person. So a considerably greater deal for you and your family of four. Maybe not so much for me as someone who will be watching alone, but at least you can watch it in the comfort of your home. And if you're somewhere where you do still have a movie theater open, maybe not in the sound of my voice if you're listening to this on CFRU, but if you are listening to this on the internet later, everyone can watch and enjoy for the low price of $30. Anyway, this is sort of coming out in the heels too of this bigger issue. Warner Brothers, which is the studio releasing Wonder Woman 1984, announced a couple of weeks ago that they were releasing all their movies in 2021 day and date. So on the same day they are released in movie theaters, they will also be released on HBO Max. I don't know what the effect of this is going to be in Canada for the screening of Canadian movies, but there hasn't been an immediate blowback from the directors, because it seems like that Warner Brothers kind of just did this without sort of telling anybody else who's involved in the production, like the directors and the producers and things. We had Christopher Nolan come out really, really harshly talking about how the greatest movie studio is now just dumping their movies on the worst streaming service. Like, I don't know what the you know, how HBO Max works or anything like that, but kind of harsh. And as Drew McWeeny pointed out in his famous, his formerly dangerous newsletter, like Warner Brothers went to bat for Nolan to release Tenet exactly how he wanted it to be released. And, you know, now he's kind of throwing a hissy fit because, like, the economics of releasing a movie right now just don't work. I mean, it would have been better, I think, if they had gone to, like, Denis Villeneuve, who wrote a essay on Variety, basically talking about how Warner Brothers manhandled everybody involved with the production because they just made this unilateral decision that they're going to dump his movie Dune and on these 20 other movies on VOD on HBO Max and didn't really seem to consult anyone. So that's, I mean, that's kind of crappy. You know, you kind of want to have your people in the loop when you're making these kinds of decisions, so that you don't get this kind of blowback. Because certainly, if you're Denis Villeneuve and say, "Hey, Variety, I want to write an op-ed in your trade publication dissing my studio," Variety's going to say, "Yes, of course. when can you have an in by, sir?" So it seems like Warner Brothers has really made a mess for themselves. Perhaps even a legal mess, because Legendary, who were the primary financiers behind not just Dune, but Godzilla vs. Kong, apparently they were not consulted too. And a lot of the money for those two movies came from Legendary, even though Warner Brothers is releasing them. So there's kind of a fiduciary requirement on the part of Warner Brothers to get the investment of these studios back, or of these production companies back, in this case, Legendary. So Legendary may be seeking to get more money from Warner Brothers because of what happened here. I mean, I have some serious skepticism about how much money Godzilla vs. Kong would make under the best of circumstances, given, you know, how those last two movies did. And Dune, I mean, Denis Villeneuve's a great filmmaker and all. I was really looking forward to seeing his Dune. But, you know, was that going to make $1 billion? Tough to say. I don't think it was going to make $1 billion. At best, I think it was going to make Blade Runner 2049 money. But I digress. If you want to talk about making money, though, you talk to Disney. And they had an investor call last week that was kind of like a Comic-Con. Now, and typically in these investor calls, you know, it's people who have like a monetary interest in Disney. They own stock, and it's just like, hey, the Disney stock was up this quarter, but that's okay because of A, B, and C, or it's down, and that's not a concern because of A, B, and C, or whatever it is. But they just released a laundry list of projects that are coming out for Disney over the next little while. I'm going to cover the movies first, because the movies, you know, there wasn't too much there. The focus seems to be on Disney Plus. If anything, it was a Disney Plus meeting, or a Disney Plus information dump, but I'll get to that in a sec. In terms of Marvel stuff, Kevin Feige of Marvel said that Chadwick Boseman will not be replaced as Black Panther in the upcoming Black Panther 2, so that it still remains to be seen what exactly they're going to do, who the Black Panther is going to be in Black Panther 2. But, I mean, that puts sort of one piece of rumor mongering to on the shelf, because a lot of people were wondering, were they going to recreate Chadwick Boseman in some way, were they just going to recast T'Challa? But they're not going to do either of those things. They have hired John Watts, who's the director of the last two live-action Spider-Man movies. He's now going to direct the Fantastic Four. I guess Marvel is feeling like he has been the key to the success of resurrecting some of these problematic properties, so why not give him the keys to Fantastic Four and see what he can do? I think he will probably do very well. They confirmed that Ant-Man and the Wasp 3 is coming, and that Jonathan Majors is going to play the villain in it. Jonathan Majors, of course, is the star of Lovecraft Country and Defy Bloods. He's had a really good 2020. And then Christian Bale, they revealed, is going to play Gore the God Killer in the next Thor movie, Thor: Love and Thunder. A lot of people thought Christian Bale was going to play a character named Beta Ray Bill, who is basically like an alien Thor. But he's actually playing the villain instead. And then in other news, from Star Wars, it was revealed Patty Jenkins, the director of Wonder Woman and Wonder Woman 1984, is going to be directing a Rogue Squadron film. Rogue Squadron, I mean, if you read the novels and comic books and video games that came out before Disney bought, before Disney bought Star Wars in 2012, there was a great big mythology behind Rogue Squadron, this legendary squadron of X-wing fighters. And I admit to being somewhat dubious about, because it seems like every once in a while we get the announcement of these Star Wars projects that nothing ever really happens with. The trilogy from the Game of Thrones guys, for instance, the trilogy from Rian Johnson, for instance, the Boba Fett movie, just on and on and on. They announce these projects and never go anywhere. But I mean, they release this kind of, I don't know, statement video with Patty Jenkins where she's rollerblading and talking about how her father was a test pilot, and how for years she was looking for a really great idea to make a movie about fighter jocks and fighter pilots, and now this is it, and she's going to do Rogue Squadron. It ends with her in an X-wing outfit walking towards an X-wing fighter. It was fun. It was heartfelt. So I'm slightly more intrigued about what that might entail. So let's get to the Disney Plus projects. There were a ton of them for Star Wars. They're going to make an Ahsoka Tano series. That character was in the Clone Wars and Rebels, introduced into the live action realm through the latest season of The Mandalorian, and now they're going to spin her off into her own show. There was a sizzle reel for Andor, which is the new series based on the character played by Diego Luna in Star Wars Rogue One. That I am not terribly enthused about because I know what happens to Andor at the end of Rogue One. They announced the, well, it's it had been announced before, but they are working on an Obi-Wan Kenobi TV show. Anakin Skywalker will return in some form because Hayden Christensen has signed on. He'll play Darth Vader. Of course, Anakin becomes Darth Vader, blah, 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 blah. I'm not sure how that's going to work exactly, because it's, if you watch the original Star Wars, it's pretty clear that Anakin, not Anakin, Darth Vader and Ben Kenobi haven't been in touch since between the time they had last saw each other at the end of Revenge of the Sith, and when they meet up again on the Death Star in the first Star Wars movie. So what's gonna happen? You know, are they gonna face off again? I don't. I'm kind of Star Wars'd out at this point. Anyway, they're also doing another animated series called The Bad Batch, which is based on a group of clone soldiers that were introduced in the Clone Wars cartoon. I may have to watch that one of these days. I would rather not. They're going to do a Lando Calrissian show. It's not clear though if it's going to be like young Lando, played by Donald Glover from the Solo movie, or if it's going to be older Lando, played by Billy Dee Williams. They also announced Willow. They're making a kind of sequel series to Willow, which I was never a big fan of the Willow movie, but it's become increasingly clear that this stuff is not meant for me. In the Marvel series, there were series that were already mentioned, introduced, like WandaVision, Falcon and the Winter Soldier, which are both coming out early next year. They showed a trailer for Loki, which is due in May, and I mean, again, I wasn't sure about this. You know, it seemed like we've kind of wrapped up Loki's storyline a couple of times. Do we really need a Loki series? Well, in the trailer, it's funny because it looks like Loki, going through time, it at some point ends up in 1970 Washington as D.B. Cooper, the famous airline hijacker who who parachuted out of the back of a plane and was never seen again. So what if we know about Ms. Marvel, we know about Hawkeye, we know about She-Hulk, we know about, although they did confirm that Tatiana Maslany was playing She-Hulk, even though there was some confusion about that. Mark Ruffalo and Tim Roth will both be in that series as well. Mark Ruffalo plays the Hulk, has played the Hulk since the Avengers in 2012, and Tim Roth played the Abomination in the 2008 Incredible Hulk movie. Moon Knight, although they didn't announce who was going to play Moonlight, there has been some rumor mongering that Oscar Isaac was going to take up that role. And then in terms of new series, they announced Secret Invasion, which is based on a comic book about the Skrulls, who were the quote-unquote bad guys in Captain Marvel trying to take over the Earth. There's a series called Ironheart, which is based on a character from the Marvel comics about this young black girl who is a prodigy, a tech genius on par with Tony Stark, who creates her own armor. There's going to be a series called Armor Wars, which is going to star Don Cheadle as a War Machine, a character that's been introduced since the first Iron Man. And then there's going to be a Guardians of the Galaxy holiday special directed by James Gunn, made in advance of Guardians of the Galaxy Part 3. That's going to be, it's going to take its cue from the Star Wars holiday special, the much maligned Star Wars holiday special that was made in 1978 as a way to capitalize on the success of Star Wars. There was some, also, they mentioned that there was going to be an Alien TV series, the Ridley Scott movie Alien, going to be made by Noah Hawley from the Fargo series fame. Ridley Scott's going to be a part of that in some way. So, I mean, it's just, there's also a laundry list of, we're remaking Three Men and a Baby, we're remaking Home Alone, we're remaking Cheaper by the Dozen, we're doing a sequel to Hocus Pocus, and it's just a ton of stuff that's just, they're not even printing money anymore. It almost seems cheaper than that. So I will leave that there, because we do have to get on with this week's stuff. I will leave it here, though. As Christopher Nolan was bashing his studio this week, he also mentioned that he was a big fan of the Fast and the Furious series, especially that first Fast and the Furious movie, which, doesn't say much about Christopher Nolan, because everyone knows Fast and the Furious Part 1 is basically a remake of Point Blank, except with street racing instead of surfing. So, if you're going to like Fast and the Furious, Christopher Nolan, starts with Part 5. Part 5 or nothing. Fast 5. Anyway, moving right along, we're going to review Mank, speaking of Hollywood royalty. Coming up after the break, you are listening to End Credits here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio.
Put aside gratitude, Mank. That you've done your best work was no accident. I removed any distraction, eliminated every excuse. Your family, your cronies, liquor. I gave you a second chance.
And for that, I cannot thank you enough.
But with credit for a risky undertaking must go the weight of real responsibility. Given your current health, I wonder if you're up to it.
And frankly, I wonder too, but we'll find out.
You may never work in this town again, Mank.
Orson, please.
Then you force me to remind you. We have a contract that you understood and agreed to. If you fight this, it will go to what your new guild calls arbitration, and you, my friend, will lose. Script, money, and assuming such a thing still exists in Hollywood, the respect of those who honor their word.
How can I put this nicely? I may be a loose cannon, but you, my friend, are an outsider. They're exasperated by me, and I've earned it, but you, a self-anointed savior hyphenate, they're just waiting to load you.
Remind me never again to work with a washed-up alcoholic.
And that was a clip from Mank. It is the new film from David Fincher, and it stars Gary Oldman, Amanda Seyfried, Lily Collins, Arliss Howard, Tom Burke, Tuppence Middleton, Toby Leonard Moore, and Charles Dance. So I'm now being joined on the line by Peter Salmon. Peter, how are you today?
Doing good. Just finished my exam, so living that holiday break life as most listeners from UGR, so congrats to you as well.
And we're about to live that holiday life because we're doing the last regular show for the year, wrapping up the year, and we will soon all get a taste of the quote unquote holiday life. Well, let's not waste any more time before we can take that holiday break and get right into this week's review, which is Mank, the new David Fincher movie. And I mean, it was on our sort of list of movies to look at, but why did you want to check out Mank? What was Mank to you?
Honestly, I just really I love David Fincher, you know? Interestingly enough, I'm not a huge Fight Club fan, but I love his work. Gone Girl, I thought, was phenomenal, and I understand why it was a bit divided, but The Curious Case of Benjamin Button is one of my favorites. If I see the Fincher name, I'm gonna watch it. Citizen Kane is just a really huge part of my life. It's one of my dad's favorite films, so I watched it with him a lot when I was younger. So it was nice seeing a film about that, especially because it's you know, a father thing for me, and the whole film, you know, that we're reviewing was written by his father as well. So yeah, I don't know. There seems something special about it. That has been 4 years, right, since Gone Girl. So or five years.
Six years.
So yeah.
Yeah, it's been a while since David Fincher has. I mean, well,
Mindhunter's cool. Yeah.
Yeah, he's directed a lot of episodes of Mindhunter, so he's not been not busy, I guess, is what I'm. Of course, they've made like two seasons of Mindhunter, and in that space and time. Yeah, I guess I come to Mank with a love of Fincher. I do like Fight Club a lot.
I feel like I would have liked it if I watched it before it was, like, you know, overly kind of memed and everything.
Oh, maybe.
Yeah.
I think it was like a 99 film that you kind of had to experience in 99 and sort of bring that in with you. But it is, having just recently rewatched it, I think it's still very solid, still a really solid piece of filmmaking and of storytelling too. For Citizen Kane, I mean, I saw it in high school when
it's been a while since I've saw it. Yeah.
Yeah. I've seen it more recent than high school. But I first encountered it in high school. It's, you know, the formative. You know, you want to get into film and learn more about film, you kind of got to watch Citizen Kane. It pioneered a lot of filmmaking techniques that are still used today. So it feels very formative in that way. I admit, though, that I feel a bit of ambivalence about Mank. I am not sure it is.
The film or the individual?
No, the film.
The film. Okay.
I did not know any much about Herman Mankiewicz before this, except that his grandson is the host of TMC or TCM. Ben Mankiewicz.
TMZ, that'd be interesting. He's a cool dude though, the TMZ guy, always slurping away. But
yeah. I don't know. I think we're kind of getting off topic, but I think that kind of makes what is his name? Paul something. Anyway, I think that makes him seem like a pretentious douche, but that's just me. How he's always got this he's always sucking on this drink.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
But Ben Mankiewicz, the host of TCM, is the grandson of Herman Mankiewicz, whom I didn't know much about. But having said that, I the movie itself I felt
kind of indifferent towards, although I recognize the film artistry. Like the technical merits of the film are excellent. I'm not sure where exactly I feel about Mank on not just sort of Fincher's timeline, but just in sort of general. I mean, there are things I enjoyed very much about it, but there are I'm kind of confused about, other than the fact it was a script written by David Fincher's father and that he's been wanting to make it for years, I'm not sure I understand what the point of this movie is, if you know what I mean.
Okay. I think the point of the film is just that Mankiewicz was more of the writer than people let on, right? I do want to say, though, that that is a bold lie. That is extremely wrong. And his father got a lot of this idea from the work, 1971's Raising Cain, by film critic Pauline Kael, who really gives a huge defense to Mankiewicz over his writing of the Citizen Kane, right? So that's what this is based around, because that was the first argument against the already acclaimed Orson Welles, right? But immediately after that, an immense amount of historians, film critics, biographers did, you know, an immense amount of actual, like, scholarly studies on the matter. And it was Orson Welles. It was mainly Orson Welles. You know, Mank, cool dude, but, you know, a lot of the stories you hear about him being the main writer are as fictionalized as the film that we viewed. So I just want to say that. I think actually that made the film even more interesting to kind of view it, knowing, you know, that bit of knowledge against the still discussed very in-depthly competition of who the true person is behind it. But there's more proof it's Orson Welles, but I think this film revolving around that idea was still really cool. I'm not sure why you did. I loved it. I really did. Mank is, if I had watched Mank before our top five, it might be on my list. Like I said, I don't even fully agree with it, but I was just an amazing look. It's a really great guy. You know, he did help write it at the very least. And I think he's just a really interesting guy. You know, he's the kind of guy who dies from nothing other than just like a liver failure. They've usually got, like, you know, some kind of character, right? Like, he lives a wild life, it's fun, but he's a nice guy. But, you know, it's also a question whether is he a nice guy, you know, like the kind of relationship things were really, really interesting with him. I don't fully understand why you disliked it. What were you expecting? Were you expecting more of some kind of Fincher artistic, you know, additions to it?
I don't know if I disliked it, actually.
Oh, you just mean kind of like Mank? You don't fully...
I feel ambivalent towards it, one of the things I get all that, the background of things, and I think Pauline Kael, her writing about Citizen Kane, I mean, it comes out in 71, right? And it's kind of this time period where it's, you know, Nixon era, post-Vietnam, you know, we're deconstructing our heroes. And of course, there's this big mythology built up about Orson Welles, especially like that vintage era Orson Welles that was like after War of the Worlds, his vaunted radio career. Then he goes to Hollywood, he's given basically carte blanche to make whatever he wants, and of course when you get into the 70s and it's the auteur era in Hollywood, you start looking backwards and go, well, was anybody like really that good? And of course you start pulling on the various strings. That I kind of get, and I understand why it would appeal to Jack Fincher as a writer, this story of about the writer and not just about the writer, but like the maltreatment of the writer, the garbage treatment of the writer. You know, there's this scene where Mank is at his protege's house, and he's wandering about this movie set, and I think it's when he first meets Louis B. Mayer, actually, and they just kind of write him, oh, that's just a writer, blah, whatever. I think that there's that kind of inferiority complex, especially in a lot of Hollywood writers, that they're second class citizens in the studio system, and they should really be given more more power, more influence. They should be held in higher esteem. So I get that kind of that point of view. But having said that, I weirdly, one of the things I couldn't stop thinking about when watching this was Gemini Man.
Okay, I didn't think about it once. What about Gemini Man?
Well, it's just that when we reviewed Gemini Man, I kept thinking about, this is like a movie out of time. I could see them making this movie in 1995, but I didn't know why they would want to make it in 2018 or 2019 or whenever it came out. I feel the same way about Mank to a certain extent. I can understand why they would want to make this in the 90s, that kind of like return of these kind of auteur aesthetic, the rise of Sundance and all that. But I'm not sure what it's trying to say in 2020, other than, you know what, maybe this guy Mank was the real brains behind Citizen Kane. And I mean, and there's also
that has already been done too, right? But
it's already been done. But there's also like there's a lot of flirtation and like the politics of the 30s and the
it's not like in your face or anything. I was okay with that. I actually really, one of my favorite parts was the comments towards socialism being mentioned, every now and then, because that was an interesting fact about him, that he was a socialist, a very devout one, and I thought it was getting a glimpse into that. We always hear about the 70s or whatever. We know about, when people were, maybe it was this era when people in the States, like for being communist or whatever, were arrested, right? So it's it delved a bit into that, which was nice to see. Although I don't even know if that was the same era, if it was the 30s and 40s they're doing that, or if it was more, it was like the Cold War era where they were doing that. But oh, either way, Blacklist. Yeah, exactly.
The Blacklist was the 50s, but I mean,
there you go. So yeah, that's what I meant. This was really interesting. I always viewed that as kind of the first of it, right? Whereas this is prior to World War One, so it's a whole thing about socialism. So I thought that was kind of just a cool glimpse into the past. And since the current, socialism is a pretty major topic, that could be a reason they picked it for 2020.
It could be. And I, when you think about the Blacklist, a lot of people in Hollywood were kind of scooped up in that because they had a hand in forming the Writers Guild, the Writers Union, which is in the background of this. So, I mean, yeah, it kind of all connects too. But I feel like the whole dynamic about, I mean, I will give the screenplay this credit. I think it has the most elegant definition of socialism versus communism I have ever heard.
Yeah, it was very well done.
But I feel like that is a happy accident that in the midst of like all this talk in the real world about, what is socialist, what is communist, I feel like it's an accident because a lot of this, a lot of the stuff about the 34 election and the funny business that Mayer and Thalberg were involved in terms of like crafting these, staging these attack ads and things, I feel like that is kind of secondary to the main story, which is this creative struggle to rectify Mank's real life experiences with Hearst and turning into Citizen Kane and the creative struggles he had with Orson Welles. And that's another thing too, is I thought the guy who played Orson Welles was kind of weak.
Oh really? I thought he was okay.
I thought he was kind of weak.
Okay. he's in it a minimal amount, but I can see why I didn't think he was great. I think during the phone call he was okay, but yeah, when he actually came in more full in person and there was more of that long scene with him, I guess I could see why you weren't ridiculously happy with it. But it was a pretty minimal role, right? And right. And I don't agree with you on the political matters. I'm okay that they brought it in. I think it helped show how different he was, Mank, from the rest of Hollywood, and how that was kind of an issue too for a lot of people, right? But yeah, I guess it took away from maybe the main focus of him writing the Citizen Kane. But you also got to think about Citizen Kane, right? And how it's not fully linear. You know, you can't delve into everything. So, you know, you could say Mank was kind of like that. So it did have to dive into these kind of pockets, well, right?
I will say that the you don't want to make the subtext text, but there is a line where Mank says something to the effect of, like, you can't tell a person's life in a movie, in a 2-hour movie. You can only get a sense of it. Exactly. And in that respect, Mank and Citizen Kane have that in common, where they're both kind of like a series of scenes, not necessarily a big narrative movie, but because it goes back and forth in the timeline and things kind of end, like the scenes don't kind of end, they just kind of peter out. they do have the, like, structurally they're very, very similar, which is why Fincher's decision to use a lot of the same camera tricks and lighting tricks and to shoot it in black and white and using the monaural sound. And you know, also the soundtrack by Reznor and Ross, no electronic music in this,
you're right. There wasn't really any standout music, but I don't
the
know
music
necessarily...
stood out. It just wasn't their normal, the thing that sets their soundtracks apart is this melodic electronic kind of sound, and they're using all these vintage instruments from the 40s, which is like a real challenge for them in terms of, like, building a score that is completely different from anything they've ever done, even for Fincher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I thought the music was okay. Yeah, I'm surprised you didn't like it as much as you did. I thought all the acting was great.
The acting was great.
Absolutely
yeah.
phenomenal. Yeah, I was a little disappointed. I thought Amanda Seyfried would be in it maybe a bit more, but I thought she was great. She played a really great, an interesting character.
I thought she was in it just enough. Just to get a sense of her. I liked her a lot, but I feel like I got enough of her character.
Yeah. I thought Collins, though, she was, I forget her first name.
Lily Collins.
But she was great. I thought she was the real standout when it comes to the woman roles. In the background a bit, but, you know, I really liked her relationship with him. I mentioned earlier, his platonic relationship with her. I enjoyed his wife's comment calling him a platonic cheat.
Yeah,
which is true, but because I was wondering that the whole time, like, with Amanda Seyfried's character and stuff, did he, you know? But no, it's just a platonic dude. I guess that's a spoiler, but he's a platonic cheater, listeners. So,
I mean,
I thought little things like that too. Like what I was talking about is alcoholism. I enjoyed just the little tidbits into his life like that.
It's just the character, like the kind of heroic intellectual alcoholic self-destructive guy is not a new trope in Hollywood, and I mean that kind of, although I liked Mank as a character, I admit that he's kind of a stereotype.
stereotypical writer,
but also like stereotypical
anybody
Hollywood
from
hero.
That film and era.
Yeah,
yeah, like that's true. Yeah, with the alcoholism and everything like that.
He's a high-functioning alcoholic who is never at a loss for words. And I think guess, anyone's ever been around someone who's drunk knows that they're not exactly at their most eloquent.
I did think, though, even in comparison to other people who have played a drunk Hollywood person, that he stood out. I thought the one scene where he goes and confronts, not his manager, but...
first.
What was that? Louis B. Mayer. Well, that...
Oh, okay. Oh, the mayor. Right? Yeah.
When he goes to the party and he is super wasted, and it's like a good, I think, 15 minutes of him doing a full circle around the dining room table, right? Giving them a whole rant about their baloney. And I thought that was great.
It was well
you think for a lot of it was well performed, but it's also for a lot of films. I would have been perfectly okay if his little rant was like the peak of it, but then him getting, fought against by Joseph L. Mankiewicz and his kind of walk of him out. That was really well done. That was, you know, that was fun. And I think that also right there shows that this did have some important aspects, I think, a biopic needs, which is not looking at him in a perfect way. You know, it showed his flaws too, which I think is something that should always be done.
I mean, it's.
But yeah, I guess his role's been done.
Right.
I guess the role's been done. I can't think of, though, like a recent alcoholic that's been as well portrayed.
Fair enough. I just that ending scene where he goes to the party at Hearst Castle and he's drunk out of his gourd. And
yeah, and he plays it well.
Not only is he able to like circle this big dining room table like a vulture, but he's like delivering this seething indictment of everyone there with all this like poetic allegory, and also at the same time laying out the entire plot of Citizen Kane. but it just, you know, that scene's been done to death. He is supposed to be drunk, but he is like highly articulate and like his frontal lobe is firing on all cylinders. It's just, the scene was well crafted, well acted, well executed. It's been done. It's been done. And all I'm thinking of is like, this guy stumbled into this party and now he's, you know, freaking, you know, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington.
Yeah, I guess. It is a part of him, right? It's not something just one person does, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just think for that sort of thing, when you're like, alcoholism's been done, right? I think it just depends on how you do it, and I think you did it in a great way. But yeah, no, I can see your point. I can see your point there. For me, I was trying to think of a good, like, that was his real standout scene of alcoholism. Were you not a fan of them kind of maybe focusing a bit too much on that, or?
I was fine with him focusing on his alcoholism. I'm less fine with.
It's just kind of the big rant then, like that kind of classic.
It's the tropes. It's just, you know, it's been done. And I'm going to confess something particularly naughty about this. I wish they had cast somebody other than Gary Oldman.
Oh, really? My wife, she's not a huge Gary Oldman fan. Not everybody is.
I'm an Oldman fan, but I just think, like, there's a scene in it where he talks about being 43 years old. And,
oh, that's your reasoning.
And
wow.
You're like, and it's like, are you wearing old age makeup? Because, I mean, I know practically that Gary Oldman is in real life 61 years old. But, yeah. You know, it's really hard to swallow seeing this man who's almost got his old age pension talking about being a washed up man in his 40s.
Well, he might have done that on purpose, though, right? Because Meg died when he was like 50 something, because he was an alcoholic, right? And he already had like fully lost his liver by the time, like, for the present day scenes of Meg, his liver was done. The liver's done, right? So, sure. Yeah.
No, I can understand how, I mean, and I've seen it in real life where people who have lived hard. Premature age, or even people who just like live evil lives, like Stephen Miller in the United States, you know, who is younger than me but looks like 10 years older than me. He's 10 years younger than me but looks 10 years older than me.
Oh,
it's, yeah, he is an example of someone who sort of ages before their time, but still, having said that, there's just Gary Oldman has this old man energy that I'm not sure is the same as washed up drunk energy.
That's fair.
But I mean, I don't necessarily have an issue with his performance. It's just in the back of my head this whole time as he's, because Marion Davies in real life was a year older than Herman Mankiewicz. It's fine. Like, Amanda Seyfried has great genes, but it just when they're that scene where they're by the fountain and at the after the party where they kind of hang out for the first time, it's clearly the age thing is clearly, and again, that's another thing that kind of reminded me of the 90s, because there was this trend in the 90s of teaming up men who were senior citizens with women who were like barely college aged. You know,
I know.
Harrison Ford and Anne Heche, 6 Days, 7 Nights, or, you know, Sean Connery and Catherine Zeta-Jones and Entrapment. It's not icky here because there's nothing sexual, as you said, but I mean, there's a cognitive dissonance here. It's like these people are not even close to being in the same age category, and it's hard for me to do that math in real time. That's just me.
I never really thought about the age that much, but yeah, I can see that. Yeah, are you sure you liked it? Yeah, you haven't really given what aspects did you like? Was there anything that kind of stood out for you?
I mean, there was a lot I liked about it. Like I said, I like the score. I liked the technical aspects of the film. I like the black and white.
Well, and the lighting was amazing.
I like the story to a degree. I like most of the actors in it. I can't remember the guy who played his brother, Joseph.
Oh yeah, he was so good.
But I remember him from the Iron Fist show. He was like probably one of the best parts of the Iron Fist show.
Yeah, Tom Felfrey's his name.
Yeah, Tom Felfrey. I liked Amanda Seyfried. I liked Arliss Howard as Louis Mayer. I liked Charles Dance as Hearst. And fun trivia fact.
He was. I'd say. Yeah, go on.
I was gonna say fun trivia fact. It's the first time Charles Dance and David Fincher have worked together since Alien 3.
Oh, is he? You're right. That's crazy.
He's the doctor.
He's a regular now. He's a Fincher regular now.
Yeah.
It's his name. How many films until his name goes on that part of his Wikipedia page? Because he's an archer that has one of those, right? Those. So I'm curious when he'll get on there. Two now. Is two enough? No, I thought. Yeah, no. Two's definitely enough. I thought he was a standout for sure. And like I said, he's the main reason I did like that real scene of alcoholism where he goes to the dinner. Yeah, I don't know who played him. He was a very minor role, but the homeless person that you see who then ends up getting a job. That was a really fun sort of thing to see. You know, those kind of people writers need to see what's going on, you know, outside of the studio. So I thought that was cool. And I thought that was a cool, a quick glimpse into the Great Depression. And it was funny because, you know, we see him broken and then we see him again post-World War II or midway. And he looks the exact same, but it's because he has a role where he's playing someone who is being affected by the Great Depression.
Right.
So there's things like that I enjoy. We get to see a glimpse into what Mank's life was like, you know?
Yeah. I did like that detail where he sees the guy later and he's been hired by Mayor and the people running the smear campaign for the Republican candidate in the 34 gubernatorial election.
Yeah.
And he's like, see, I have a job being a homeless person now.
Yeah.
There's something really funny about that. And I did like the earlier scene where he says to Mank, hey, can you give me a dollar? And then Mank turns to the security guard and says, hey, can you lend me a dollar?
Yeah.
That was well done. Yeah. I love those touches.
It also, you can really tell it was itself written by someone who was a writer, like a Hollywood writer, because there's a lot of, you know, little details too about the writing world I wasn't aware of, or Hollywood in general, you know. I had no idea that there was this huge rumor going around about Hollywood moving to Florida, and it resulted in like a wide amount of people moving to Florida. So I thought that was really cool. So I thought there was a lot of fun things like that, just a little tiny glimpse into what it was like back then. Again, it was focus on Mank, so I'm okay they didn't dive too deep, but as I think a lot of biopics should do, there was enough little fragments of what the time was like back then in the background.
Well, the whole thing about that campaign is why it's kind of disappointing that he didn't put more of a focus on it. I think a whole movie about that would be interesting in its own right, because I mean that some of those same tricks are used in this day. I mean there are still companies. Yeah, that, you know, if you live in a company town and you are searching for way to make more profit. And maybe you go to local government for more tax breaks. And they're like, ooh, well, you know, that will lead us into a budget crunch. You're like, well, maybe we'll just move our whole operation to Florida. I mean, it's still a tactic used in a lot of businesses.
Yeah.
It's
well, also just going off of that, I do think this was very present in 2020 because there has been, again, a huge rise of hatred or American fear towards socialism, right? Because of Bernie Sanders, right? People in the States are starting to really go against it and communism, you know, almost to a similar degree as the Cold War or this, you know, 1930s, right before World War II. So I thought that
I'm not sure it ever went away for that matter. I think it's always been.
Yeah. Oh, in Hollywood, but I mean, like, just in general. Very
well, yeah, in general. Yeah.
No, it's always been there, but I mean, it's making more public. We're hearing more about it because of the elections and things going on. And because Bernie Sanders was the first one in a while who really, you know, identified as such.
Yes.
But what I meant was, yeah, it's always been like that. And that's part of the reason, right? Like why it's we're looking at something that's set in the 40s, and yeah, it's the exact same in the States. Mm. So I thought that was, yeah, that was interesting.
And here's another thing I liked about it. It's shorter than most Fincher movies.
Yeah, I thought it was a good length. It was a bit over 2 hours, but yeah, I liked it.
It's a little bit over 2 hours, but it's not like Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is like almost 3 hours long.
Yeah. No, I loved Meg. I did. It was a perfect length. I thought the ending was good too. It's a Fincher film, and you know, I am who I am. I would have been okay if we didn't even get like the oh he died, this is when he died, or this is what happened after. I would have been okay if they just, I don't know, stopping at a more place that would leave questions, I guess. I also think would have made it a bit more feel like more Citizen Kane, right?
Yeah, it's Citizen Kane ends with him never finding out that the what Rosebud means, and it shows them burning the sleigh. So I mean, I guess it literally does. Well, it doesn't leave the audience with questions, but it leaves the main character with questions.
I mean, it doesn't do like a quick rush and like answering, you know, a bunch of questions you're asking.
You're right. I think I would have liked it better if they had if it just ended with the 42 Oscars and neither Wells nor Mank there to accept. And I mean, I don't know what the newsreel thing of Mank's doing a ad hoc acceptance. I don't know how real that was, but I mean, it also seems like a writer's flourish, like flipping the bird at Orson Welles, even though both Mank and Wells have been dead for decades. But what are you going to do?
I think about Mank too. One thing I want to point out, and I think maybe why I loved it, because I said I don't absolutely love Fight Club. Seven, you know, it's whatever. Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, it's okay. I think there's just some aspects of his work that I find maybe a little pretentious, I guess. I think there's some color contrast and some audio choices in those works that are a bit too out of control for me, or not necessarily out of control, but too different, too dark, I guess. I'm not sure. He there's some of his works where it seems like he tries too hard to make it distinctly Fincher work, which it can happen with a lot of like Lynch. That can happen with everybody, right? Mm-hmm. So what I liked about this, it was as great a Fincher film as all his others, like when it comes to the acting and directing. But it was, I'd say, a bit more of a basic biopic than some of his previous work. And I personally liked that. I was surprised. I thought it would be a bit more pretentious, but it was just kind of a fun, really, really well done biopic. I do love a lot of his artistic aspects too, but I think he just went all the way into just the money of this and what I guess he thinks Mank deserved, and his father being the focus as opposed to his own kind of artistic urges. So I can see actually why, because there's a lot of Fincher fans who aren't a fan of it. But I think, yeah, Mankiewicz is an interesting dude, right? You know, biopics, if the dude's kind of interesting, or if the person is kind of interesting, they're going to make it, right? And because of the socialist aspects, I think there's films that would make less sense to matter in 2020. Mm-hmm.
Well, given your enthusiasm, Peter, I will let you have that last word. And if people want to talk some more about Mank or whatever, you know, how can people find you on the internet?
As per usual, Peter Wesley Salmon on TikTok and Mr. Tarak on YouTube and Twitter.
And that's it for this week's show. We hope you liked it, and if you want to listen to it again, you can find it on our website, endcreditsradioshow.com. You can download it on the Guelph Politicast channel every Friday on Podbean, or you can get it through your favorite podcast app at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. And speaking of that Spotify app, search for End Credits on CFRU, and you will find the playlist for all the music we play here on End Credits every week. You can find us on social media on Facebook at End Credits Radio Show and on Twitter at End Credits Radio. I will be back tomorrow at 5 p.m. for News and Politics on Open Sources Guelph with Scotty Hertz. In the meantime, I'm on Twitter and Instagram at Adam A. Donaldson. You can find me on Guelph Politico at guelphpolitico.ca. And you can read my writing about horror movies at Nightmare on Film Street at nofspodcast.com. And stay tuned for more great programming here on CFRU 93.3 FM, CFRU.ca, Guelph Campus, and Community Radio. And we will be back next Wednesday at 3 p.m. for a Christmas-themed edition of End Credits. And we will see you then.